Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I don't know what closure is, but I will do absolutely anything to get it. And joining me is a girl who's doing really good, actually. It's Monica Heise.
Hi.
This is an interesting one, because it's a funny day for me, because we started talking about weddings in the morning with Lauren Bravo, which, if this goes well, the first episode of the season will be weddings, and the second episode of the season will be breakups.
Right.
So we're running the whole gamut.
Nothing in the middle.
Nothing in the middle. No, just like a happiness and muddling along. No one wants to see it.
Hmm.
And what's been fascinating me, and what I'm like really excited to do more in this season of the podcast, is, yes, keep this sort of thing that we've been doing all along, which is looking at specific texts and being like, okay, what's the take home from that? What's the cultural little nuggets we can find in there? But what I'm becoming more interested in is, like, what are the things that culture teaches us to expect from certain life events, weddings being one of them, breakups being the other? Because I do think that if you grew up in, like, a nuclear family, or even if you have divorced parents or parents weren't together or whatever, the likelihood is you're not going to see a lot of breakups around you, but you are force-fed them through television and sitcoms, which I think probably for you as well as me, sitcoms were in a major way how I learned about the world.
Mm.
And they're just like full of breakups, because that's what you do to move story along, right? You have
conflict.
Conflict, yeah. Right? And Frasier bangs someone for two episodes and then there's a problem with them and then they must go, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, like,
God, did you learn about emotions from Frasier?
I mean, I'm listening. Just a big guy who listens to people in my recording booth all the time. This is how it's happened. So you are someone who was divorced unusually young,
mm-hmm.
has written a book partially inspired by that experience,
mm-hmm.
and is also a known sitcom writer. So I'm kind of excited about how all those experiences and identities mesh together.
Ooh, me too now. You're really selling me to me. I'm listening. Okay. God, what am I going to say?
What's she going to... Yeah, not really a question, more of a comment.
Okay, yeah. There's probably great stuff in there. I'm excited.
So yeah, like, where do you want to start with first? The unusually young divorce? The learning about conflict and relationships and resolutions through TV, or the book in general? What made you decide to write it?
Yeah, I mean, the unusually young divorce was kind of what prompted writing it. I got divorced when I was, or started the process of separating when I was 28. Mm. And it was pretty isolating, because that was kind of the age where people were maybe starting to get engaged.
Mm.
We had kind of jumped ahead a little bit. My ex was a little older than me, so his friends had been getting married and we got married. And then I found myself having failed at that right when everyone was just sending out save the dates, which was a pretty isolating experience on its own. And I think not uncommonly, when people are feeling isolated in their experience, they maybe look for film or television or books to kind of show them that they're not totally on their own.
Mm.
But I couldn't really find anything out there that spoke to this particular experience of being in your early 20s and going through a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fairly uncommon... circumstances would have had to have been pretty extreme for someone in a generation above ours to kind of jump out that early.
Right.
So there wasn't much out there. And what the divorce, obviously there's tons of novels and shows about divorce, but it's all sort of like 40 and 50 year olds, and they're dealing with custody and they're figuring out who gets to keep the house. And I was sort of like needed to move out of our one bedroom apartment because we couldn't afford the rent on our own.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a cat, no possessions of value whatsoever. So it was a really different, it was basically just like a juiced up breakup.
Yeah.
It had all this cultural baggage and then was just otherwise a terrible in your 20s breakup.
And I guess there's this thing, I mean, I imagine this happened at the time where like you have probably a lot of people saying to you like, oh, well, you know, at least it doesn't matter because, you know, I mean, not that exactly, but like people being like, oh, at least there's no kids, at least there's no property, at least you get a clean break, at least. But I imagine it must have been very minimizing and being like, yeah, but also I've technically speaking failed in a marriage.
It was the opposite situation where I was like, at least we've got no kids, haha.
Yeah.
And everyone else was like, but your marriage is over.
Oh, with the reverse. Yeah. Okay.
And I was like, oh yeah, I guess it is bad. And so one of the things that I wanted in writing the novel was to acknowledge that it is devastating, or can be devastating, and it's very painful and difficult, but also something that treated heartbreak with a bit of a light hand.
Yeah.
A lot of the breakup stuff out there is pretty heavy duty. A breakup is considered kind of like the worst thing that can happen to you. And it does feel that way at the time. I mean, the interesting question is like, would it feel that way if the art was different?
Yeah.
But I wanted to read or watch something that was a bit like, this is terrible and ridiculous. I'm a very maybe confusing to friends because I'm a loud person, but I don't actually love to be the center of attention.
Mm-hmm.
You do feel very exposed during a breakup, I think, because humans are curious. You know, we want to know what happened, who fucked it up. What are you going to do now? Or who's seeing someone else, you know? And I think that feeling of being looked at is part of what fuels people's interest in kind of building a story around the breakup, so that if people are looking anyway, at least we can get a clear, cohesive, you know, win, basically. This is why I think people try and win breakups, is because they feel like everyone's already looking.
That's very true.
So they're going to make meaning out of this situation anyway, so why don't I be in charge of the story?
About everybody's already looking, and so the need to have a script, a story, a sort of a branding for this particular type of breakup, a messaging, I think that is the stuff where people start borrowing from culture, right?
Yeah.
The idea of like, I mean, the stuff that starts in TV or whatever and then just bleeds through to culture. The idea of like, it's not you, it's me, or like, I, you know.
I don't know that there's a specific touch point because it's so ubiquitous, but like, I definitely was very interested in the concept of a glow up.
Yes.
Post breakup, I was like, well, okay. I'm
everyone's already looking.
My butt's gonna get so firm that I won't be sad anymore. which didn't work. My butt got really firm, but I was still so sad.
But you still, you know, you found a real love of spinning.
Yeah, I still love spinning. It's very unlike me. That's one nice thing about breakups is you get really tender and open to stuff that you might not have been open to.
Yes.
And so I went fully got into spinning. Unironically, love to spin.
Unironically, love to spin.
And in the pandemic, I really missed, I really roll my eyes at the stuff they say in spin class. And then in the pandemic, I realized it was quite an important part of my week. I missed it so much.
Oh, no.
Just some like really muscular kind of guy named Brad.
Yeah.
Being like, it's so important to move your body. Good for you for getting here today. And there's some part of me that needs that. Thrives off that.
Just plunged in total darkness. A spotlight just on you.
No maybe. Spotlight, please. Total darkness total only.
Total darkness only. When we talk about like you being this sort of unusually young divorcee, and then I'm trying to imagine what that was like, receiving like wedding invites. When does it like cast a kind of cynicism over everything in other people's relationships? Is it hard to really believe like when you were going through that?
I think that's when if anything, you're like, oh, everyone else has found the right person,
really?
And I just did it wrong.
Yeah.
But that's when you're being ridiculous, and that's sort of what the book is making fun of, is like this period where you're like, ah, everyone at the wedding is looking at me.
Yeah.
No one's looking at you. There's literally a bride in a wedding dress you know, making promises to try and love someone forever. That is much more interesting than some sad woman in the corner. No one's looking.
No one's looking.
And so the novel is kind of about a woman who doesn't yet know that no one's really looking.
Yeah. But the thing, you know what? So, a piece of advice I have grown increasingly frustrated with is when people are like, no one's thinking about you, you know, or whatever. Because we are in this kind of watcher culture, the kind of the Instagram stuff or whatever, where we're kind of, we are curious animals and piecing together clues about each other all the time and being like, she sounds like she's having a breakdown.
I can definitely tell if a couple is going to get divorced on Instagram.
Oh yeah, what are the signs?
They start posting a lot about how much they mean to each other. And I think especially they do like a thank you post of like, just need to shout out this one for being incredible. Crisis. That is
crisis.
A crisis. When, why would you do that in your, you know what I mean, on Instagram?
Just want to shout out this
one. Like, oh, this one's been my rock. He's like a star. It's not always easy, but he's the only one I want. Mm-mm. 6 months.
6 months. Oh, no.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting. There's a few, I wouldn't call them celebrity couples, but, you know, just below that. Somewhere between influencer and celebrity, like known people, where they've gone really hard. They haven't, the interesting thing about like relationships growing and fading online is like generally there's the soft launch on Instagram stories.
Important.
There's like, you can glimpse him, his coat in a mirror kind of thing, or she's suddenly wearing a man's clothes. Mm. She's generally very femme. Like, who did you sleep over in that night? Or like a hand in a Guinness, or like cheersing kind of thing. And then he'll obviously eventually, the hard launch will come on the grid, which will be like, this one's birthday, you know, and you're like, who is this one?
I think the most elegant version of that is when you hide them in the carousel of photos. So there's like,
oh yes,
like they're like three or four photos in, and it's like, ooh.
Peekaboo. Little peekaboo. Yeah, actually, you know, you're right. The carousel, sort of like the debut there, and then the full star moment. He's getting the full stage.
Yeah.
But then when they start winding him down, I find that even more fascinating. It's like, haven't seen him in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when I see a lot more of women after a night out in their bed still talking to camera. And that's when I know he gone.
To camera, yeah. If you're talking to camera, something's gone wrong.
Something's gone wrong.
I was going through my Instagram stories during my breakup, like in hindsight, to write the book, I was looking at them, and it was a very different style of posting than I would engage in now.
How would you describe that style?
It, like, unhinged, like it was a lot of to camera stuff and like stuff that it was just like I was clearly arranged in like flattering kind of poses, and then kind of talking nonsense. In retrospect is so transparent.
Yeah.
So transparently, like, I'm having a tough time. Someone needs to say something nice.
I'm having a tough time, but my makeup looks good today.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's something that you cover in the book, which is the like, and something I recognize in myself as well. Not even just as like post breakup thing, but more like she's having a tough time thing is the, it's the Twitter thing of this character who's constantly joking her like acerbic one-liner is where she clearly thinks she's being like Dorothy Parker and her poison pen and her poison wit. And everyone's just looking at her being like, why are you a cunt?
Yeah. I really wanted to get into that habit that I definitely have taken part in and that I see a lot on Twitter in particular of like young women kind of describing these debasing experiences that they've had, but in a like kind of way. And I think it, you know, people think they're sort of doing that Nora Ephron thing of like, well, if I'm telling the story, then I'm getting the laugh.
Yeah.
But it's like, are you getting the laugh, really?
Yeah.
And do you want to get that laugh? And it's hard because I don't want to condescend to anyone and suggest that they aren't doing what they think they're doing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've participated in this, so maybe speaking only for my own behavior, it was sort of like picking a scab instead of like leaving it alone and letting it heal. It's like you pick the scab, so then the wound is fresh, so you can go back and get another one. It wasn't great for me anyway.
It's a roughie. It's interesting. You brought Nora Ephron, and it's made me think that you said that there was sort of no material out there when you were going through your breakup of youngish people who were experiencing this level of breakup. And then I kind of go immediately, the first thing I thought, I was like, oh, how old was she in Ardburn kind of thing? Because, you know, I know she has young kids in that, and I think she's like late 20s, early 30s.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, it's kind of a generational thing more than an age thing.
Exactly.
Nora Ephron is hard to read now in general because she's like relatable queen. Like, she feels bad about her neck. But then if you read the essays, it's like, it's almost impossible to find a building with a good doorman.
It's so true.
I don't know how to relate to that. You know, like, even the rom-coms, like the frazzled book editor who lives in this like two-bedroom apartment or whatever. It's just different.
Oh, totally. But I think it's like in completely, and we've talked about Nora Ephron on this podcast before, but it's a well that never goes dry for any, ever. But rom-com is a different thing because you're going to a rom-com to see beautiful things. Mm. And I don't want to see someone in a rom-com with a shitty apartment.
Interesting.
I want to see a beautiful place and a beautiful woman in it.
Interesting. I guess Bridget Jones's apartment is still...
It's still...
She's got a fireplace.
She's got a working fireplace. But then you read Nora Ephron's essays, and there's literally an essay in one of her last collections about how she thought she was going to inherit a lot of money and turned out it was only 30 grand. I was like, how is this going to become?
We've
like,
all been there.
He's still a relatable queen.
I'm obsessed with the breakup in You've Got Mail between Greg Kinnear and
My
Meg
mother.
Ryan. I know. I'm like, watch one other director, please. And I've seen the work of Rob Reiner as well. In You've Got Mail, Meg Ryan has this sort of doofus writer boyfriend who's everyone's like, oh, are you like the character in Heartburn or whatever? And I'm like, no, I'm like Greg Kinnear in You've Got Mail. specifically the part
just
where
he's bringing his typewriter home.
He's bringing home all these typewriters, and then he's like telling an anecdote on TV, and Meg Ryan's like, I've heard you say that before, and he goes, yeah, well, she hasn't. That's it. Anyway, they're breaking up, and their breakup is so amicable and friendly.
Yeah.
And you can see the tension lift between them really instantly once they've said that it's not working. And I think some breakups can be like that. That's like the platonic dream of a breakup. Both of them are like sort of into someone else. We've been growing apart for a while. Yeah. There's literally no hard feelings whatsoever.
I love that.
It's gorgeous. And it's funny. And it's charming. And
they become so much more charming to each other. And she's like,
instantly.
Oh, who is she? Kind of thing. It's like, it's so funny. And like the bit when they're just before that scene, when they're in the cinema and she's like, I didn't vote.
Yeah.
I got a manicure.
And
sorry.
I forgot. See, that's very Nora Ephron too. Yeah. Like, that's quite out of touch behavior. These days, I don't think you would put your relatable heroine as a non-voter.
Yeah, it's so weird. That choice now, quite
I got a
and
manicure and
then.
Forgot to vote? Are you kidding me?
You would be like torched off the platform.
I've got some infographics to send to you, Kathleen Kelly.
And then, like, staying on Ephron, there's the When Harry Met Sally, Surrey with the Fringe on Top moment.
Oh, yeah, with his ex.
With his ex.
The run-in. The run-in is a big fantasy thing, I think.
Yes.
I think it looms very large the first time you see an ex.
Yeah.
And what will it be like? What will you be wearing? What will they be wearing? I mean, that's what that whole Adele song is about.
I mean, Adele.
Which one? Which one is it? It's not Someone Like You.
The one about heartbreak?
Yeah, it's the sort of wise beyond its years Adele song about heartbreak. There's an Adele song about seeing someone who was important to you across the room at a party and you didn't know they would be there.
Yes.
And I think that's a big, you know, moment in real life. That's one of the ones that feels real. I don't think that's been inflated by pop culture.
Yeah.
I think running into your ex for the first time feels intense and charged and weird. It never goes in a way that's intense and charged and weird, but the first time you see them, you get that bad roller coaster feeling.
It is bad roller coaster. And it's done so well in that movie where they're trying out the karaoke machine in this like department store.
Yeah.
And it's like the worst song for them to be
it's
singing.
It's so funny.
It's so funny. When they take you
and Billy Crystal's like body language is so confident and goofy. And then he's just like instantly deflated by the drippiest looking woman ever.
Helen.
And Ira.
No. I think about the ex running. Obviously it is like, yeah, you want to be looking your best, wearing your best, being your most hilarious, wonderful self. And that you get that swooning thing when you see them of like, oh fuck, this is not what I planned. Like when I think of my last big ex run-in, it was, you know, your classic time frame, that sort of 6 or 8 weeks after we'd broken up, and we ran into each other on the tube, and it was just like end of the day of work, you know, you having that shine on your forehead, you know, just cold, and but wearing a lot of coats because it was winter, but then on the tube it's really hot, so you're just kind of sweating in down.
Fantastic.
And and having this awkward conversation, and obviously and afterwards being, oh god, that was fucking awkward, and the same sort of emotions of like, oh wow, this is somebody who I really thought I was going to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're this odd stranger who still lives on the same tube line as me. How odd. But I think what actually breaks my heart more, and what I sort of wish I could say to that person who left that tube that day, is like, that's the last time you're ever going to see him. Because it was the last time I ever saw him. And I'm not going to run to him again, really. He lives somewhere else now, you know?
Do you think? Like,
I don't think we're ever going to see each other again. He was my last ex-boyfriend before Gav. And now I sort of think to myself, like, what would you have said to him if you knew that was the last time you were ever going to see him?
But would you have said something dramatic? I feel like...
No, probably not.
This is where pop culture leads us.
I think I would have hugged him, I think, or something, you know. I hugged him and meant it, maybe.
That's nice.
You know?
That's where pop culture leads us astray, and I'm part of the problem in terms of writing stuff like this.
Yeah.
Where there's, like, a speech.
Oh, a speech!
There's always a speech. And I love to write the speech. I love to watch someone do the speech in a different show or film.
Yes.
But I think if you did the speech in real life, it would go really bad and really poorly.
really poorly.
And and the other person would be quite alienated and weirded out.
Yes.
Like, I can't imagine a situation where "Is it raining? I hadn't noticed" would go down well. You know?
Oh, yeah.
It's raining so hard. That's such a nuts thing to say.
Where did it come from?
I think maybe it was supposed to be raining less. And it was one of those things where, like, on the day they're filming it. Because it's quite romantic if it's lightly raining. That's lovely.
I think, sorry, Andie MacDowell, I think she's a shitty actress.
Oh, no.
And it was supposed to be, like, a sarcastic, oh, is it raining? I hadn't noticed kind of thing. Like the
Even then, it's raining too much for that to work. It's raining
hard. But because it's raining so hard, it's, like, it's a sort of a joke.
Maybe. But the character is kind of a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, but she just ends up delivering it so sincerely.
It doesn't.
And it's so strange.
Make any sense. It doesn't make any sense.
No sense. What about celebrity breakups? Which ones have hit for you?
Helena Bonham Carter and Tim Burton, because they had what I thought was the dream arrangement.
The houses.
Separate houses directly next door, connected by a tunnel.
I need to know more about the tunnel.
The fact that that didn't work was a real blow.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, so that's fine. I understand how to make a relationship work long term. You get rich enough to acquire two downtown townhouses, build a tunnel between them, and then you happily ever after.
And we never got to find out why. I mean, we never get to find out why, and that is the irritating thing about celebrity
breakups. I think
breakup.
She did a very candid interview about it.
Did
actually.
She?
Yeah, what'd and
you
now
learn?
She's got a sexy young boyfriend.
Oh.
Like, much younger boyfriend. I think she came out the other side of that breakup.
Yeah.
In a way that I think is maybe fairly classic and that you don't actually see reflected in the pop culture narrative, which is that the woman hurts more sooner and hurts less in the long run.
Yes.
Not to gender essentialize.
Yes.
It's 2022.
Yeah.
But
I do think there is a gendered way with which people experience breakups.
Straight breakups, anyway.
Straight breakups, exactly. I remember my brother said this to me once. He said that men and that was very profound at the time. Men and women sort of grieve in reverse, and that like the moment my ex-girlfriend forgets about me is the moment I remember her. Like, I know, sorry.
It's true though. It's like men have this straight men have this sixth sense for once you've deleted the number.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 What's that?
I don't know how they do it. What's that?
What's that? I as a teenager, had too many boyfriends.
Okay. So we had different upbringings. That's interesting. I'd never even considered that as an option as a teen.
Yeah,
let's say I did not quite have that problem.
My thing was that, like, and I don't like this about myself.
Okay.
Is that I was very insecure. And so I would go out with people who were more insecure than me.
Mm.
And I would want them to feel, like, lucky.
Wow.
You know? So I wouldn't even necessarily be that attracted to them. And they wouldn't necessarily have the... Nerds. I'm saying nerds.
Nerds. Do they know about each other?
I'm saying dating nerds. See,
did you have a little stable of nerds?
I had a stable of nerds. Well, but the thing is, because Cork is quite small,
mm-hmm.
and if you spend your whole life there, start dating quite young, and then go to college in the same town.
This is like Toronto.
People start converging on each other. I remember one day getting out of a lecture hall and seeing a gang of five boys and three of them I had dated. And I was just like, This is not going to get out of here.
Yeah. I got to move to London.
Yeah, yeah. But
gotta find the nerds in London.
And she did. But yeah, I was kind of like, I just needed to sort of feel admired and it didn't really matter how I felt about them. It was just, please give me appreciation. I needed to. I don't feel proud of it. But also when it came around to the breakup part of it, I used to really just try out saying the maddest shit.
Oh no. Okay. Like you wanted to say stuff that was cinematic, or you would give reasons for the breakup that were...
I wanted to say stuff that was cinematic. I want to say stuff that felt cool to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The one that sticks in my head, and I don't feel good about it. I'm not bragging about any of this.
Okay.
He said, I said, I think we should break up or whatever. He said, but we love each other or something like that. And I said, I looked sort of away from him and went, I can live without love.
Wow.
But I can't live with this.
Wow.
And I remember feeling like...
And you were how old?
15.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember feeling like I was Scarlett O'Hara. But it was like this little... I think that's what I meant when I said earlier on, like, that breakups allow you to be sort of the main character for a while.
Yeah.
I think I was a bit of a sadist, a bit of a sociopath in that regard, where I was just like, I live in this quite boring provincial little city. Nothing really happens for me or around me, so I'm just going to make these situations.
I think there is a certain amount of leeway that you feel like you get as like a romantically bereaved person.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
People sort of let you be a bit of a piece of crap.
Yeah.
And that can be, I can see what you mean about that being freeing. Like, and you can skip things and you can say things that are a bit too much and you can drink a little too much at dinner.
And
like kiss someone on the dance floor or something kind of slightly past the age where that makes sense.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, well, okay.
She's on good. She's doing her.
It didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, that main character syndrome really gets in your blood because people don't write movies about couples that have a nice work-life balance and share home chores equally and support each other. You know, there's no conflict in there, which I think means that there's not a ton of drama, which I don't mind personally.
I don't mind.
I'm always getting in trouble.
I don't need drama.
I'm always getting in trouble for submitting scripts where people are quite nice to each other.
Yeah.
Not a lot happens.
Just enjoying one another.
Like the stakes are like there's a small misunderstanding and it gets sorted out right away.
Right away.
But I think that's another thing in terms of breakups in pop culture that people are horrid to each other and then don't break up. And I wish that they would. There are so many relationships on TV where like I'm not rooting for that couple.
Were you ever a Gilmore Girls fan?
Yes.
When it came back for A Year in the Life and Lane Kim was still married to that fucking toadstool. I was like, no, she should be on the road with her band.
She
and
should
her
be
music.
In the city. Yeah, she should have gotten out of there. I mean, there were almost no good relationships on that show.
No.
Between men and women. I mean,
no, men and women were not supposed to live together.
No, it's just supposed to be fast talking girls having a good time.
Yeah, and men bring us breakfast.
Yeah. I mean, Milo Ventimiglia in that show was very important to me as a teenager.
Important.
It was very important when he showed up, but like by a creek, I want to say.
With like a paperback slid in his back pocket.
Yeah. I was like, okay, he reads.
Yeah,
okay.
Dean doesn't read.
They are so similar looking, those boys, basically. One of them is a little longer than the other one.
That show did great hair for men.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, tune in for Gilmore Girls. Okay.
But do you know what I mean? These relationships on TV where because they want more conflict, the way that they talk to each other is just terrible.
Yes.
Or they think like, that's just how people talk when they're really being unfiltered. I'm like, I've never spoken to anyone like that in my life.
Why is it? Is there one in particular that's standing out?
Ross and Rachel.
I was just about to say.
Ross and Rachel. And we want the conflict and drama for TV. It's like, will they, won't they, will they, won't they? No one's asking, should they?
No.
Shouldn't they?
Yeah.
They shouldn't.
Yeah. And it's this thing of like, it's very Hollywood reasoning of like, it is written in the stars because they've known each other since they were children.
Yeah.
And therefore, I've actually been doing a rewatch of Friends, kind of a cozy background while I do my laundry, sort of rewatch. And even though I don't think anyone really thinks those two characters should be together, I will say how they pace their various breakups and get back together is, I think, is kind of magnificent.
Mm.
The thing of when he comes back from China with Julie and then Rachel is agonized for a few weeks and then he breaks up with Julie or no, she kisses him and then it all seems like they're about to get together. Finally, we're two seasons in. We've had this going for so long. And then he makes the list.
Yeah.
She's not Rachel.
Really good.
Chubby ankles, a little spoiled.
Chubby ankles.
Oh, just a waitress. It's
just a waitress. That is really good drama,
it's,
you know.
So good drama. Like, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that's devastating.
Yeah, and it's the choice of things.
Ross is such an asshole.
He is sort of the best TV asshole has ever been, though.
That's the worst reason I ever stopped seeing someone, is that we were at the pub with a bunch of friends and everyone was saying which friend they were, and he was like, I'm Ross, and I was like, absolutely not.
Absolutely. I'm not gonna be with a Ross.
Fine.
Yeah.
It's never gonna be Ross.
But it was weird. It's like they've got this sort of thing then with like kind of almost multimedia breakups and get back togethers, because it's then they get back together because they're watching their prom videos, and there's this thing where it's revealed that Rachel was almost set up for the prom. And then Ross goes upstairs to put a tux on to take her.
Oh, yeah.
And then he comes back down the stairs and she's gone already.
And isn't that...
Destroyed me.
Yeah. Devastating.
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Don't get me started on Ross. Toxic nerd.
Toxic nerd.
Toxic nerd.
Very evident. When I talked about the nerds I went out with when I was in secondary school, that's
Ross.
We're in Ross area.
A lot of Ross.
But this brings us on to, I think,
it's gotta be Jen Aniston.
Jen Aniston.
Yeah.
Like, people want to talk about Adele or Taylor Swift as being these like queens of heartbreak, but she is this her high priestess. Like, she's been there this whole time. And the thing is, what makes her a martyr of breakups, this like patron saint, is because it's been thrust upon her and she doesn't want it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Adele and Taylor Swift can both make their art from it. So it's sort of, it comes back to the fucking Nora Ephron thing.
Yeah.
Of like, who's in charge of telling the story? And Jennifer Aniston, it didn't feel, had any control whatsoever on the story that was being told about her love life. Yeah. It was basically like she was being like punished for having dared to date the prom king in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, what did you think would happen?
It's so interesting that I haven't thought about that being such a big part of why Jen Anne is the heartbreak queen. Because you're right, Adele and Taylor Swift, they have this power. They have their writing, their songs, their music.
And to a certain extent, they're interested in talking about it. Whereas Jennifer yes. Aniston has always said, yeah. please, can we get over it? And everyone's been like, no.
No. But because she was so powerless against the narrative, people related to her more because they feel powerless against their own sort of personal narrative of being abandoned or left for another woman or whatever.
Right. That sense that everyone's looking at you and talking about you, even yeah. though you don't want to be defined by this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because she isn't a writer, like she's a really good comic actress.
Oh my God, she's so good.
The power, she doesn't have that power to create art that will correct the narrative. So what happened for a while was obviously there's like the kind of constant back and forth with Ross Mitchell and friends. So we know her as somebody who's unlucky in love from that anyway. And then reflects in real life immediately with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, the whole thing. The Mr. and Mrs. Smith thing.
Yeah. That was a really...
It was a summer, man.
A stunning turn of events.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you couldn't have planned it, but worse, I guess, from her perspective. Like,
yeah.
Not only was her gorgeous husband, like, stolen away by this famous like vixen, like yeah. this gorgeous, mythologically beautiful kind of bad girl, and Jennifer
who drinks
Aniston's,
blood, you know,
yeah, and like and makes out with her brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, fuck
why
her.
Why did you do that? But like, it really couldn't have gone worse in terms of like the people involved being interesting and like just such clear kind of parts, like the roles were very clearly drawn.
Yeah.
I don't know how you could, you know, I don't think she handled it badly. I think
there was
I can't imagine. Yeah, what would you do?
Well, I mean, there was that kind of thing where she sort of tried to reclaim the narrative by having that movie quite soon after with Vince Vaughn called The Breakup.
And what is The Breakup about? I mean, I assume a breakup, but
yeah, no, it is like about this kind of ordinary couple who live together and then they break up, but they're still living together in the same apartment.
Mm.
And it's all about the antics and things that they pull each other and how it starts off sort of amiable-ish and then becomes really poisonous. And then eventually they end up back together.
Right.
It's not great, but it's one of these things that like just traded so heavily on the fact that, well, this is how you're already thinking about her. And to her, probably felt at the time, well, this is my way to reclaim this narrative.
I don't think she could have guessed that it would be something that stuck for decades, to be fair.
No.
Like, it probably seemed she like she could do a cheeky whatever wink to the
probably felt camp.
Like when they had Brad Pitt on Friends
yeah.
as a guy who hated
Rachel. Yeah, yeah.
I think she was probably like, this is sort of cheeky like that, not knowing that this was going to be like a dominating story of her yeah. life, which is so unfair. I'm getting really...
I know!
annoyed on Jennifer Aniston's behalf. She doesn't need our pity. She's doing great.
She doesn't need our pity and she's doing great. I'm sure I'll watch the morning show someday. But... And then it's like... What's even more painful for really just living through the Jen Anne naughties experience.
God, should I get highlights?
Is that she was this like girl next door, wholesome kind of character, the most beautiful girl next door that could ever possibly exist.
Yeah.
But still, she had this kind of wholesome neighborhoody vibe about her that we knew through Rachel. And whereas Angelina Jolie was like sexy, ethereal witch.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the narrative continues, Angelina Jolie becomes the refugee saving mother of seven or whatever. Mm. And they become this weird, wholesome family. And Jennifer Aniston gets cast as this sort of like childless older woman kind of thing. And like, oh, you know, it's that. And then she becomes the witch.
Well, I think that the childlessness is probably the source of the story lasting
yes,
so long.
Exactly.
If she had just gone and done the thing she was supposed to do and had babies with some other handsome Hollywood person,
yeah,
everyone would have been like, and that's the end of her story.
So true.
Fine. But she's fine.
It's like people see it as like a ... question mark because they're like, but she couldn't because there's no...
Yeah. And I, it's until you've opted out of one of these, until you've opted out of like a, I don't know, like a heterosexual relationship, which is like
yeah.
the dream end goal in, I think, society's mind for straight women, for women in general, probably. They just want us all set up with men. Mm-hmm. Right after my breakup, people started asking, do you think you'd ever get married again? Like, instantly. Like, we weren't even divorced. And it's everyone's kind of first question. I've been getting asked it a lot on the press tour for the book as well. Like, would you get married again? And I'm like, so irrelevant. And and a really weird thing to ask someone whose marriage has just fallen apart. To be like, imagine feeling better and then meeting another person and then trusting them enough to love them and then deciding to have another big party in front of everyone to say that you love them. Would you do that right now? I don't know.
Gun to your head. What do you think?
Yeah. And I think that, like, the second that you kind of opt out of one of those, it's like, why would you let go of a marriage if you had one? You know?
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing with Jennifer Aniston. Like, why haven't you had kids then? You know, why haven't you? Which is such an insensitive question. There are so many reasons that women can or can't or do or don't have kids. I'm rambling and I forget why I started.
It's Jen, so it's always relevant.
But it was about, it was to do with people kind of obsessing. Oh, I know what it was. It's to do with people deciding that your tragedy is over once you've opted back in. So I remember running into an acquaintance with my new boyfriend, like maybe a year and a half after my divorce. And I had a new boyfriend, very new. Mm-hmm. And we were like holding hands on the street and ran into a mutual friend of me and my exes. And I could see them be like, oh, I'm not worried. There was like relief and kind of like happiness for me. And, you know, I had been through a very difficult breakup. So some of that is just nice and normal, but also I think there's a sense of like, oh, thank goodness she's found someone else, so she doesn't have to be like this loose end that we don't know what to do with.
Yes, I can close that book in my head.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think the kind of, as you get older, the version of that is having kids.
That's so true.
Just such a bummer.
It's
very unimaginative.
You have to create life to prove you're okay.
And this comes back too to most of the stories about women that we see in the media and in culture and stuff, focused on breakups and weddings and these big kind of romantic milestone moments. Mm. So we have like a low cultural imagination about other things that can be important in a woman's life.
Yeah. Low cultural imagination is such a good way of putting it. Like, I often think about I just think about the divorce part a lot anyway. Just like, if my
just
mind,
think about it.
It's like the screensaver, you know, that Microsoft 95.
Like, yeah, she is wearing the Chanel boots. Good for her.
Good for her. It's like, you know, when you look at a screensaver on an old Microsoft computer, those pipes.
The pipes? I think about those pipes all the time.
That's just like, the divorce part just starts playing in my head. Suddenly I see. Her face, the map of the world.
Yeah.
But like, that is a movie about like a woman's toxic relationship with a job and her boss. And the just that Adrienne Grenier plot does not need to be in there. I get, like, you could have a friend character or just the friend character.
Right, disappointing your friends.
Right. He's a fucking negative charisma in that movie.
Yeah.
And it's that thing you go back to of the limited cultural imagination, unless we see what effect her job is having on her romantic relationship with the sexy man, then we don't understand what she's truly losing, which is her very womanhood itself.
I think movies about women back then in particular were all marketed like rom-coms, even though you're totally right that film is not about that at all.
Yeah.
It's not about her romantic life, and you're totally right that the boyfriend could just be a friend. And in a way, him being her boyfriend, he's sort of a famously bad boyfriend of film.
Yes, yeah.
Like every couple of months, there's like a tweet that's like, you know who fucking sucked?
I'm here for it every time.
Adrienne Grenier in The Devil Wears Prada. Support your girlfriend. You're a 35-year-old man freaking out about your birthday.
Shut up.
He's a chef, though, so it does make sense that he's kind of a jerk. Isn't he a chef?
He is a chef, yeah. And I remember that because he talks about, that's $18 worth of Jarlsberg. It's just a line that goes around in my head. And he makes her a sandwich. Shouldn't be that much. It's not a good cheese.
A thing that a jerk chef would say.
Yeah. I always go back to that character. Think of that actor, because like the way that Entourage sold him as being the biggest, most famous movie star in the world, and we couldn't make that happen for him culturally.
I know. I've never seen Entourage, but I do think he seems charming.
Yeah.
Is he not?
I don't know. He's fine. It's a bad show.
I don't know anything about Grenier.
How, when we're talking about like moving on from Jen Ann, but that thing of like when a breakup is so huge that it needs to be mirrored through different bits of art and culture and stuff. One that really sticks in my head is the Cry Me a River music video that Justin Timberlake put out.
That was a big breakup for sure. Because that was like...
That spun me out, man.
Because for, I think, millennials, that was like our teen prince and princess.
Yeah.
Couldn't make it work. And it was what? Because she cheated?
Well, that was what he implied.
Right.
But that was the thing. It was like, I cared a bit when they broke up because Britney and Justin, they've just been there for a while. But then he released this video where it's supposed to be him in her house. And then at the very end, it's like a lookalike he's hired, who's wearing the sort of fedora, the Britney of that era kind of thing.
Mm.
And he's, just sort of like filmed himself having sex in her bed. And then she has to come in and watch it.
Oh, my God.
It's really vicious. And comes back to something I care a lot about, which is like Justin Timberlake is a toxic person.
Wow.
I hate that man. He's my most hated man in culture.
I'll never forgive him for what he did to Janet Jackson.
Forgive him. All he's ever done is profit off female misery.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that he implied that she cheated after they broke up, because that, I feel like, ties back into the thing we were just talking about of like the only real thing you should be doing as a woman is securing a male partner and then eventually having babies with him.
Yeah.
And the worst thing you can do is get out of a relationship with a man if you already have one. And the worst way you can do that is by betraying your male partner by having sex with a different man.
Yeah.
It's just... Ugh.
It was something we talked about a lot with the End Just Like That episodes. And I know...
Oh my God. Do you know how many women have come up to me and said, are you Monica from Monica's Ass?
Oh my God, I can't believe we didn't say it. This is Monica from Monica's Ass. You are like...
It's me. Also,
it's like New York was a character on the show. Your ass is a character on this podcast.
Because also the way that Dolly explained it in the podcast makes it sound so much more salacious than it is. I'll break my legendary silence on this topic right now.
Okay, explain why it's called
Monica's ass is called that because I got drunk on tequila on holiday in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And my boyfriend had taken a photo of me in the pool where the water had rippled in such a way it had distorted my admittedly already juicy bum to make it look like cartoonishly like it looked like it was filling the pool.
This is incredible.
Like
ass.
A vulgar
like a Pixar
cartoon
dump truck ass.
Pixar mom in the pool on the holiday, and I drunkenly sent it to the group chat, and it's now the group photo of
and the
chat.
Group name
Monica's ass,
which I believe was my doing. I think probably my strongest contribution to
culture. And that'll be my legacy ultimately.
You've written on Schitt's Creek. Mm-hmm. You've got your own TV show coming out.
Throw it in the bin. Monica's ass.
Book. Monica's ass. But anyway, when we talked about And Just Like That, and the thing, like, obviously that show was a fucking mess in many ways, but the thing that Dolly and I really enjoyed was the Miranda's infidelity storyline. Like, obviously you can have opinions on Che Diaz or whatever, but I think it made sense. It made sense that she would cheat on that man.
As we found him. As we found Steve, the husk of Steve that they left us with. I'm a Steve truther. I love Steve. Steve is in my top five men of Sex and the City breakdown. And
what's going on?
Piss politician number one.
Oh my God, you and Dollar.
Piss politician number one.
Yeah.
David Duchovny in the institution number two.
That's so you of you.
Steve,
okay.
Harry.
Yeah.
And maybe Burger, but not. I don't want him to be there. I don't like that about myself.
David Duchovny and Burger are kind of the same thing.
You're
just
right.
At different stages of life.
Maybe Justin Theroux.
Oh, yeah.
The family
rather than Justin Theroux at the party.
Or no, sorry, Smith Jarrett, obviously.
Or Smith Jarrett, duh.
Smith Jarrett, obviously. Oh, above Harry, for sure.
I don't
sure.
know why I don't ask everybody who comes on the podcast what their ranking is. I should make that a
piss
thing.
Piss politician number one forever.
Yeah.
Harry did him really dirty.
It's just a bit of piss.
It's just a bit of piss. Oh, you're a sex comment. Don't give me. This is a different podcast. It's unrelated. Sorry. You were saying that the infidelity story, I think it's very interesting in pop culture that we decided that infidelity pop culture and regular culture. We decided that infidelity is like literally the worst thing you can do to someone else. There are so many, to my mind, worse ways that someone could betray you in a relationship. I don't think it's great to cheat on your partner. Yeah. I'm not like, you should just do it. I'm French
now.
No,
it's not great, but I think it's worse to be mean.
Yeah, I think it's worse to, I think it's worse to be mean. And the
like
thing
to be openly
is,
mean.
Cheating can come with things like gaslighting or lying or, you know, not being careful with someone's sexual health and safety, and all of those things are mean. So I get that it's like complicated, but that's always the story in a big breakup story when people are managing a public breakup. It's always like, who cheated?
Who cheated? The interesting thing about infidelity and people's reaction to that storyline on Just Like That is people are so, so scared of it. And like almost everybody, if you're going to live any kind of like rich or full, like long romantic life, you're going to be on all sides of that triangle eventually, right? Whether you know it or not, you know?
It's like
death, taxes, and infidelity. It's just all there. And like, but I think it's like people think that if we sort of talk about it, rationalize it, talk about the reasons people do it, and maybe, it, you know, it, us even saying, is it really the worst thing in the world though? People are almost afraid that if we make it more permissive, then more people will do it. And it's like, if we speak about it, it'll come true. It's like Candyman in the mirror or something, you know?
One thing that I'm really proud of in the book that I feel like is kind of missing from a lot of pop culture depictions of breakups is that it's a lot about her friend group and the work that they're doing to support her in a breakup. I think in both like media coverage of people's breakups and also the like movies and films and stuff, breakups are this kind of isolating thing, and they do feel and can be quite isolating. But if you're lucky, I think most people have, you know, a couple of friends that they can lean on in those situations. And those people are doing big work for you. You know, you're in a really privileged position if you have friends willing to kind of come pick you up off the floor during those moments. And I really wanted the book to kind of shine a bit of a spotlight on those people. And the main character is not enormously aware of the amount of help she's getting for the first kind of two thirds of the book. And there's a real wake up call for her that actually, you know, she's been complaining so much about being so alone and so lonely. And she's been surrounded by people the entire time who want to help her and who are trying to help her and who have formed a side group chat to stop her cutting and bleaching her hair. And, you know, which is another one of those classic pop culture breakup.
Oh, yes.
Transformation.
Watching that man right out of your hair.
The transformation fantasy, which is so much less good for you than sitting around with your friends and actually engaging with them and talking about your feelings and also talking about something that's not your fucking breakup, which is so important as well.
Yeah.
Which I think, all of it's focused on. So much of the breakup messaging we get is like, this is about you, this is about you, this is about you. But you don't stop being a person in your community and you don't stop having other things that matter in your life, even if you feel like you do.
Yeah. And it's also, there comes a tipping point in all breakups where it does become a to go back to the scab thing, like picking the scab over and over again, and like thinking that if you turn it over again and see it from a new angle, that, you know, some new insight will be revealed about his character, his behavior. I'm using sort of a straight dynamic or whatever, but or something that did say that, oh, that time I went to his mom's birthday party and she was dismissive of my present, kind of thing. That's where it all began, kind of. And it's just never going to happen.
Well, maybe that's the big damage that pop culture has inflicted, is the idea that there's like a clear story at all, which really in a relationship, there are so many big and things that led or didn't lead, you know, choices and changes and reactions or like failed bids for attention or whatever, and all of that's cumulative, and it's very rarely one thing. And I think that's why something like cheating is so appealing in a story, because it's so clear.
Yeah.
And it's so much simpler than saying, you know, we were not compatible in some ways from the very beginning, and we maybe could have survived that if one of us had started therapy earlier, but we didn't. And then I had that work trip, and then,
yeah,
you know, he started getting really into this hobby that I found alienating, and then I never really liked his mom, and you know, like,
yeah,
there are so many big and small reasons that relationships don't work, and it's not a clear and tidy story kind of ever.
Oh, and that is kind of the major disservice that like pop culture gives us. Is you're so right. It's like the framing of a three-act structure around something, that there's going to be like that one moment that, yeah, because it's like sometimes in order to survive the things that happen to us, whether it's like breakups or any kind of grief, it's helpful to cast yourself in a narrative, and you're like, this is the part where my glow up happens. This is the part where I go to therapy, and this is the part where I really bond with my therapist. And then you go to therapy, and it's like, well, it's actually boring, and like,
yeah,
which you're really good at doing in the book is her relationship with therapy evolving over it, and it very slowly becoming helpful, which is actually how therapy works.
It's, I remember so distinctly telling my therapist, I've been in therapy a long time, not to brag. But I, you know, the book is in some ways like a horror version of like, yeah, what would it have been like to go through that big breakup without having a pre-existing relationship with a therapist, or with even having quite a distrust of therapy as the narrator has. But I remember telling my therapist at one point, like post-breakup, like, I'm just in this really annoying stage where we've done enough work where I know what I shouldn't want, but I haven't done enough work to not want it still. So I'm just aware of the things that I want being bad for me, and I have to just sit there and not do them, but I haven't quite figured out what to do instead. I'm not really that motivated to do the thing I know is more healthy, so I'm just sitting at home having a timeout from my own life.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But I think this all ties into that main character thing you were saying about, like, the urge to narrativize these experiences comes from, like, you're like, okay, well, everything's happening to me and it's all going to lead to,
me meeting the guy or me suddenly having an amazing career.
Yeah.
and like, we find it useful to, like, view our life stages as being montages and zooming out from them. It's like, okay, well, this is a boring gym class, but once I zoom out from this and it's progressive gym classes, and then I look amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm strong and I run marathons and I meet Bill on the marathon. And it's like, you know, that Joan Didion quote that people in publishing love, which is, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And I remember my friend Otega said this to me once, and I found it so clever. She was like, people use that quote as like, so buy a book. You know what I mean? but tell us a story and learn live. Buy a little story. Why not? Yum, yum. But actually what that quote is trying to say is we are fooling ourselves constantly. We are laboring under these extravagant fictions we build around our own selves that don't exist and don't end in any payoff.
Yeah. I think there's a bit of a fear of like the mundane or the everyday kind of happen a play in those moments where it's like you don't want to admit that the process of getting over something like this is going to be slow and boring, and it's going to involve a lot of like soft hangouts where you're maybe operating at 7% and like you're not really like this exciting newly single person on an adventure. You're just like a slightly wounded person trying to sort out how to be again. Yeah. And that's way less fun than being like, I'm your messy broken up friend. Here I go. Yeah. Now it's the montage part. Like, you know, you have to live all the bits between the montage as well.
I can imagine there's going to be at least a few people who will have seen this come up in their podcast this morning and will be like, oh my God, because like a third of every woman, a third of all people are having a breakup at any time. That's what I believe. And they're going to be like, oh my God. And so for anyone who actually is in the thick of this right now, this horrible bit that you experienced, that everyone has experienced, what would you say?
Well, I would say it's going to be bad and then it's going to be fine. I think there's no point in pretending it's not going to be a little bit bad.
Mm.
But it really will be fine. And that's the thing that you lose sight of. And that's what makes grief, I think, or heartbreak in particular. I can't really speak to like proper losing someone grief. But heartbreak feels so devastating because there's something about it that really makes you think it's going to be forever. Yeah. I'm going to feel like this forever. And it's like, oh, of course you won't. Yeah. And that's what I think is funny about it in a way. It doesn't feel funny in the moment. It feels horrendous. But then it, part of you knows even, like, you know, when I was going through my own breakup, I had already been heartbroken before once in my life, quite badly, my first love, and I broke up, and I was so shocked to find that it felt exactly the same.
Yeah.
I thought it might feel worse because we had been married, but it felt exactly the same as the first time. I think it feels exactly the same every time. It just feels like somebody ripped open your rib cage and shat in it. But it stops feeling that way eventually. It really does. And there's nothing you can do except feel a little bit like that every day. And then eventually you'll feel less and less like that. And my friend Ebony said this to me when I was going through my breakup. She was like, you'll be really surprised how soon you start to feel better.
Yeah.
Because you think it's going to be forever. And then it'll feel so sudden that one day it doesn't feel like this anymore.
Yeah.
Even though it's going to be kind of bad for a bit.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And that kind of goes the same for like friend breakups as well.
Oh, God. I think friend breakups are in some ways worse because we don't have any scripts for them. No. At least you can romanticize.
I know.
The
right?
breakup.
And also, the worst thing about friend breakups is that you can have loads of friends. For most people who aren't like pursuing a kind of polyamorous lifestyle or whatever, you're kind of only going to have one partner and you kind of have to make sure there is the best choice for you that they possibly can be to ensure great survival and a nice family life down the line. But you can have as many fucking friends as you want. So when you stop being someone's friends.
Yeah. No, they're real. Some of the worst breakups of my life have been friend breakups,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah.
It just hurts. So I think maybe. See, I was thinking from this whole conversation that all of these scripts we have from pop culture are so limiting. But now I'm like, maybe it's useful to have something just so you can at least think like, well, here's what it might feel like or might look like, or here's what it might be worth it for when you're really in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And when you're in the thick of it with a friend breakup, you're like, I'm the biggest loser in the world.
I can't keep a fucking friend alive.
Yeah, I'm the biggest loser in the world and I'm never going to make another friend. So it's a sort of similar feeling, really.
Yeah.
But there's no like glow up and people don't kind of feel bad for you. And there's none of that kind of social leeway that you get with heartbreak.
Totally. And also it's like, there's kind of a broadcast that goes out when you break up with a romantic partner that doesn't happen with a friendship. So people will be like, oh, I saw so-and-so the other day. And you're like, oh, please never mention, never say that name to
also, me. Also, one thing I found when I became single again was that kind of like past flames sort of could tell from my unhinged Instagram presence. I was single and started like reaching out a little
Sniffing
bit.
Around.
But that doesn't happen when you lose a friend. It's not like new friends or like, oh, what's up?
Or you're in the market. You're taking CVs for new friends.
You can't quite throw yourself into like the effort of trying to make a new friend because it's a bit more, it's again less like codified than dating.
Yeah.
So the process of doing it is a bit more haphazard and random. So you're just like, well, and there they go.
I would kill a man for like, it's never going to get greenlit, but like a TV show about a friend breakup.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I know what the exec would say, which is, where are the stakes?
I mean, there must be something about that. I feel like Hacks is a great show about
friendship
in a way. Although it's also about mentorship and like.
Yeah. Monica Heisey.
Hi.
You have a book coming out very soon.
I do.
Really good, actually.
Yeah.
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 It's such a good book. I loved it so much.
I'm so glad you liked it.
Awkward if I didn't.
Talk to me for like an hour and a half. Be like, Monica has a book coming out. It's fine.
You know what? She's got some things to say. No, it really is fabulous. And I like it. I haven't been properly heartbroken since I was about 20, I think. Like my first uni breakup or whatever was like a real big one for me. And as you said a minute ago, reading that book, I was like, oh, all these little scars, I can still feel them, actually. They never go away. And like, it's this incredibly like human thing to like just touch on those scars again. But also with this book that's incredibly empathetic and just really fucking funny. And like, it reminds you that it is this kind of, natural thing of being alive. We all experience this crushing disappointment of love just fading or not working out.
Yeah.
And it's just a real bam to have something that's like funny and just lovely about that.
Thank you.
Thank you for writing it. You also make TV. You've got a show coming out.
I have. I wish I could tell you the title of it, but we haven't got one yet.
I mean, just
we just wrapped shooting on Friday.
You don't have it?
Yeah, no, we haven't got a title yet. They're focus grouping some titles, so.
Oh, are you going to sit behind the...
No, glass? No, they don't. I don't know anything about it. Okay, we'll have a title eventually. It's a romantic comedy, and it's coming out on Sky in end of March.
Holy hell.
I know.
What a year will be for you. This might be the last time I see you.
No.
Oh, we've got that Christmas lunch.
Monica's Christmas.
Monica. Okay, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram @Zaraline.